McGraw-Hill Ascent Audio presents How to Be an Ally, Actions You Can Take for a Stronger, Happier Workplace by Melinda Brianna Epler. Narrated by Terry Lee Fellows. Publisher's Note. This book quotes from original documents which contain sensitive language. In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures and tables present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Preface. No one is born a great ally. Knowing everything people are going through, how you can best support them, and also how not to hurt them. Allyship is a journey, and each of our journeys looks a bit different. I certainly was not born an ally. I've been working on it for many years. As a white girl, I feel lucky that I grew up in Oakland and South Seattle, both areas that were very racially, ethnically, and economically diverse. My friends were from many cultures, and about equally mixed boys and girls. I didn't have any non-binary friends that I knew of at the time. I learned from my friends who celebrated Chinese New Year and went to Chinese churches, Samoan Americans who celebrated and shared their cultural traditions with pride, Japanese Americans whose families had lost their homes when they were interned in World War II and worked to heal and re-earn their wealth, recent Laotian refugees trying hard to fit in and build a new life, friends who grew up poor and black or wealthy and black, very privileged white sons of lawyers and politicians, and daughters of parents with disabilities just barely getting by. My family was white middle class, living on a majority white upper middle class street in a very economically, racially, and ethnically mixed part of town. My schools were majority minority, where my high school reading list included the white male canon, William Shakespeare, Leo Tolstoy, George Orwell, Charles Dickens, and Nathaniel Hawthorne, but also authors like John Okada, No-No Boy, Anne Frank, Diary of Anne Frank, Malcolm X and Alex Haley and others, Autobiography of Malcolm X, and Tazaki Shange, for colored girls who have considered suicide / When the Rainbow is Enough, Michelle Cliff, No Telephone to Heaven, Alan Paton, Cry the Beloved Country, and James Welch, Fool's Crow. My teachers quite literally filled in the gaps of standard curriculum with cultures and perspectives left out of our history books. I supplemented this further with lots of books by Latinx and Indigenous authors. And in college, I continued to read, expanding deeply to Middle Eastern, Latin American, and Indigenous authors. My family traveled to Mexico in middle school, where I met girls my age selling handmade baskets to tourists instead of going to school. And that was when I first began to understand the disparities and inequities in our world today. In high school, I led my school in an exchange program with the USSR during the Cold War. My family welcomed Soviets to stay in our home, and I stayed in a family's home in Uzbekistan, then part of USSR, to help bridge peace. Homelessness, economic disparity, gun violence, and the threat of nuclear war consumed my thoughts, as did prom, physics, varsity soccer, and, yes, band practice. I grew up deeply believing that our breadth and depth of uniqueness matters. I learned how important it is to find commonalities among our differences. Reading, having diverse friends, and traveling. Together, they created in me an internal value that difference was important and wonderful. And I grew up knowing that we had work to do as a world, to bridge peace and understanding, and to right very deep-seated wrongs. But it wasn't until my first quarter in college that I realized that racism still exists, that we do not live in a post-racial society. During my first few weeks of college, I'm walking through the quad in the center of the University of Washington campus, and happen upon a group of black students talking about the injustices they face daily, and working through what they are going to do about it. I listen for some time. At first, I go through denial. They are just stirring things up, I think. Then I hear more about their experiences, and it sinks in. My denial turns to anger, frustration, sadness, and guilt. I was very wrong. How could I have been so wrong? How do we live in a world that pretends racism and discrimination are in the past, when the reality is that my colleagues and friends experience it every day? in classrooms, walking down the street or into a store, getting a job. Basic things I take for granted are daily barriers for them. Despite having seen the entire Roots series 4 or 5 times in school from a film projector, and reading Black authors from around the world, I had in my head that it was history. While the racial and ethnic injustices I learned about might still exist in other countries like South Africa, I thought, and I was taught, that they were well in the past for the United States. Today, I am still ashamed I didn't recognize it sooner. I spent the next 9 years in college sampling different courses and degrees, learning new perspectives and tools, trying to figure out how I was going to change the world and make it better. I'm still paying off that college debt, but I'm grateful for all that I learned. I studied cultural anthropology and Native American history, Black social psychology and literature, Middle Eastern history and literature, Latin American film and literature, LGBTQIA+ studies, and environmental justice. And, equally important, how change happens over time in societies when someone or a group of people stand up and work together for collective good. Then I moved to art school in New York, followed by film school in Los Angeles, to learn how storytelling can create movements and change the way people think and feel. To pay my way through school, I worked with kids who were Somalian and Ethiopian refugees, kids of parents recovering from addiction, kids without housing. I worked on research projects that studied facial expressions and empathy. And, of course, I worked some typical student jobs, including waitressing, which brings a whole other set of patience and empathy skills, and cashiering, which, due to repetitive injuries, gave me a temporary disability in both arms for about a year and left me with lifelong chronic pain. I watched films from around the world. I also spent my school breaks backpacking and camping throughout Latin America and the United States, and saw firsthand the injustices indigenous people face, the richness of cultures, and the resilience of people across our continents. It wasn't until many years later that I realized that sexism exists around me too. When I studied art and learned just how many women artists have been literally written out of history by men. At the time, Black and Latinx authors were often placed in a box called outsider art, a coded term for not being properly educated in art and not interacting with the art canon. The moment I realized history is usually written by elite white men was a big one for me. This unfortunately continues to play out in today's go-to sources for facts on the internet, like Wikipedia and Google. History is written through a biased lens. Whether intentional or not, erases diverse leaders and experiences, cultural knowledge, and unique, diverse truths. It was several more years before I recognized my own experience with sexism in the workplace. It had to knock me down before I did. Looking back, I experienced pretty severe sexism and harassment in several of my early jobs, but I didn't recognize it. If you are just now awakening to racism, sexism, ableism, and other forms of oppression, you are not alone. We don't see what we don't see, what we don't want to see, what the world doesn't want us to see, until our awareness opens, and then we might begin to see it everywhere. It was several years later before I recognized the challenges faced by women with intersectional identities. Latinas, Black women, Indigenous women, trans women of color, women born in places where gendered violence and severe discrimination are socially normalized and accepted, people with disabilities, veterans, anyone in the LGBTQIA+ community, religious minorities, people who have been incarcerated, and people with many other underrepresented and historically marginalized identities. And I'm still learning. Allyship unfolds throughout our lives as we receive new information, meet new people, and put ourselves in new and often uncomfortable situations so we can learn. Your journey of allyship will no doubt be different from my own. And yet, when each of us embarks upon our own journey of allyship, collectively, we have the power to make the world a better place for us all. The world's systems, processes, and popular culture are out of balance. tipped in favor of some of us in the world, at the expense of the rest. This does not mean that we don't all work hard to get where we are. It means that some people have to work much harder to succeed due to many barriers put before them. Allyship is understanding this imbalance in opportunity and working to correct it. It's taking action on your values of fairness, justice, and giving back. As allies, we learn, unlearn, and relearn. We work to do no harm ourselves. We advocate for people. And when we're ready, we lead the change. We will explore some of the many ways to take action as an ally in the coming sections. Your allyship doesn't have to be big or take a lot of time. You get to decide what type of ally you'd like to be. An ally takes a little risk, gets a little uncomfortable, then takes another risk, and another. Over time, we become better allies, and, as a result, better humans. The first time my partner Wayne Sutton and I put together an allies panel at our tech inclusion conference in 2015, it was new and awkward. The folks on that panel were brave. It was early in my own discovery about the concept of allyship. Since then, we've invited many people on stage around the world to talk about allyship. I've spoken on many stages and at many executive tables teaching allyship globally. And we've worked with several hundred global companies and organizations, and thousands of individuals, to drive diversity, equity, inclusion, and allyship. In the following chapters, I'll share with you what I've learned as I've worked to become an ally, as well as some of my own struggles as someone who needs allies as well. I've had the honor of interviewing and hosting a number of people on stages around the world about allyship, and I interviewed a number of people for my podcast and this book who will share their experiences here as well. This book also draws on a global study we did at Change Catalyst, learning what people want most from allies, why allies do what they do, what the biggest challenges are for allies, and how allyship can impact the workplace. Allyship may be a new idea to you, or you may have been an advocate or activist for years. I wrote this book for all of us. Many new allies were born with the rise of awareness about racism after George Floyd was murdered in 2020, and the violence against Asians and the Asian American and Pacific Islander, or AAPI, communities during the COVID-19 pandemic. If you're one of those folks, welcome. This book is for you to learn some of the context and skills to create much-needed change by being an ally. If you've been focused on allyship or advocacy for women or for LGBTQIA+ folks, but haven't really done much around being an ally for people with disabilities, Muslims, Indigenous or Latinx folks, this book is for you. No one is a perfect ally for all groups. I've added context around allyship for people with many different identities. If you're an executive, employee resource or affinity group leader, or focused on learning and development, human resources, diversity, equity, and inclusion, this book is for you. Perhaps you are thinking about how to put a program together to build empathy and allyship. I've added some frameworks and discussion-generating questions you can use to facilitate deeper conversations and actions. Take your time with this book. Allow yourself to explore the kind of ally you'd like to be, and take the steps to become that person. Introduction. How I hit the glass ceiling and bounced back. In 2013, I hit the glass ceiling hard, and still to this day, I have shards from it embedded deep beneath my skin. The glass ceiling exists for many people rising to the top of their fields and companies, where we hit the limit of what opportunities are open to us because of our identity, gender, race, ethnicity, disability, sexual orientation, and or other historically marginalized identities. It's glass, so we might not see it right away, and the people around us usually can't see it either. All my life, I've worked to make the world a better place. I began my career as a documentary filmmaker. After several years, my work evolved to creating movements of change by combining storytelling with behavioral science. I partnered with non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, governments, and Fortune 500 companies to build social change using social marketing, branding, behavior change strategies, and storytelling. I also advised social entrepreneurs, became a popular sustainability blogger, and volunteered and served on the boards of multiple nonprofits and advocacy organizations. While leading several global branding, marketing, and social impact campaigns with my clients, I was offered a job in-house as an executive at an international engineering firm in San Francisco. Like many companies, this organization was working to stay strong in an industry dominated by ever-enlarging global conglomerates. This company wanted to be the go-to firm for women in engineering and wanted me to help them get there. That sounded fantastic. They told me my branding, storytelling, and marketing experience was exactly what they needed to shake up their brand positioning, storytelling, and marketing strategy. My experience in organizational and cultural change was exactly what they needed to build a healthier and more scalable culture, put human resources operations in place, and manage process and culture integration in a few upcoming mergers and acquisitions. And my social impact and behavioral science expertise was perfect for leading a new business service for our healthcare clients to help them improve sustainability metrics through behavior change initiatives. The CEO had courted me for about a year before I finally said yes. 3 times he asked me to work for him. I said no each time, because my business as a brand consultant was growing quickly, and I liked working with multiple clients to make a positive impact in the world. Finally, I decided to take a leap. So, I closed down my successful business and moved across the country to start changing the world in a new way. I was chief experience officer, leading marketing and culture, and also responsible for building a new service line for clients on sustainability behavior change in the healthcare industry. I worked with some of the nation's largest healthcare systems, using technology and culture change to radically reduce their waste, energy, and water use, and improve their social impact. It was my dream job in many ways. I was creating real change in the world and making a significant positive impact on the company's sales, marketing, and engagement. But that job became the worst professional experience of my life. While I was doing meaningful work in the field, I was miserable as soon as I got back to the office. I was the only woman on the executive team. And while I was used to being the only in my life, I was not ready for the deep assault on my expertise, the lack of respect, and being undermined and belittled throughout my time there. While there were bigger issues, most of what happened involved behavioral patterns and personal slights that slowly chipped away at my ability to do my work well. Here's an example. I'd spent the first few weeks in my role hitting the ground running on client delivery and listening, learning, and developing a plan to meet the marketing and culture goals I'd been hired to achieve. My first major presentation at the company was to share the strategy I developed with my 19 colleagues on the leadership team. After being introduced by the CEO, I looked around the room at my fellow executives, eager to share and discuss my plan, and I watched as they immediately picked up their phones and looked down at their computers. They're not paying attention. As I started to speak, I'm thinking they will begin to pay attention out of respect and hopefully interest. But they don't. Instead, they quickly jump in and interrupt me before they've even heard what I have to say. People talk over me again and again. Some of my ideas are flat out dismissed, and then a few minutes later brought up by someone else and championed. It was deflating, and as it turned out, it was not an isolated experience. I soon began to realize that only a few leaders in the company truly believed in the CEO's vision of becoming the go-to firm for women. Many of my colleagues didn't care to be led by a woman, and, they told me directly, they felt that to actively hire more women would be lowering the bar. In my case, not only was I a woman executive, but I was also an outsider, not directly from their industry. It was clear I didn't belong. Data shows, and my CEO believed, that diversity was exactly what they needed to stay strong in the market. Someone to bring new perspectives from many different industries, with a different set of innovative skills, and who would challenge leaders to make their work better. As a consultant, I became good at quickly learning culture, language, and processes of new industries. I had already consulted with them for about a year, so I knew their business, and I brought with me a lot of ideas and successes from other industries.
but to many leaders at this firm, my being an outsider was another reason not to pay attention to my ideas. They absolutely were not going to give me an opportunity to succeed. From the start, they had made up their minds that as a woman and an outsider, I would fail. Once on board, I learned the company did not have good experiences with the couple women executives they had hired in the past. Somehow, each of them turned out to be not the right fit. Yet, I was an idealist. I believed the CEO when he told me about flaws these women had, and that by contrast, I was the perfect person for their company. I know the CEO believed this too. Sadly, we both had a lot to learn about the company's culture. Several years earlier, I'd worked in the film industry, where sexual harassment was an everyday experience for me. I thought it would be better in corporate America. Yet, in some ways, it was worse. While I experienced sexual harassment, a lot of what I experienced was more subtle, and I didn't understand it at first. I believe most of it was unintentional. My colleagues' behaviors were rooted in the norms established by the company culture and in their individual biases, which were formed over their lifetimes and perhaps handed down over generations. The little negative behaviors and patterns I experienced daily from my colleagues slowly chipped away at my confidence, undermined my leadership, and reduced my capacity to innovate. Former White House Chief Technology Officer Megan Smith calls what I experienced death by a thousand paper cuts. In this case, I think I was feeling shards of the glass ceiling along with these paper cuts. It's there, this insidious, and so many people, women of all races, men of color, experience what I call death by a thousand paper cuts. Megan Smith. When people experience acts of exclusion, there is a psychological as well as emotional consequence. Reflecting back to that room where I gave my first presentation. Despite my years of experience and expertise, I was negatively judged before I'd said anything. Sure, I was a bit nervous for my first big presentation in front of this group, but I was prepared. I had done this many times before. My plan was a good one. And like a good corporate executive and coalition builder, I had talked with many of my colleagues individually to get their input beforehand. Yet, I was knocked off my feet from a lack of people listening, the constant interruptions and my ideas being taken as other people's ideas. I lost my energy and confidence because my expertise was being questioned. Then, my fear and stress response kicked in, and I experienced what's called the amygdala hijack. My brain was stuck in fight, freeze, or flight mode. In social situations, my brain often chooses flight. So my brain was focused on how to fly out of that room. I was no longer fully functioning as the innovative, confident, and challenging thinker that I am. I began to sound flustered, and soon found I was saying a lot of ums and ahs in an attempt to keep people from talking over me. By the end, it had unraveled into a mediocre presentation at best. When your voice and expertise are silenced, it's nearly impossible to be an effective leader. If the people in that room had challenged my ideas, then we could have had a robust debate. But they had never heard my ideas, or perhaps worse, they heard my ideas in passing and suddenly claimed them as their own. I was the only woman in that room, except for the CEO's assistant. And I could have used an ally. An amygdala hijack can be interrupted at any time by someone who helps change the dynamics in the room. An ally could have recognized what was happening and helped stop the interruptions, could have asked people to put down their phones, and could have subtly pointed attention back to my ideas and strategy. The disrespectful behaviors I experienced in that meeting room continued every single day I stayed at that company. Behaviors and patterns like this, when they happen over and over and over again, wear you down. Pretty quickly, my energy was tapped, my confidence was shot, and I was miserable. Exclusion can break you. It can change how you show up. It can lower your self-confidence, change your work identity, make you less productive. Because you're working against many barriers, and because it's exhausting, make you numb and distant, and lead you to build protective armor around yourself, which can cause all sorts of other issues. We will explore this more in the following chapters. About a year into the job, I hit rock bottom and felt like a complete failure for the first time in my life. At a real low point, I read an article about toxic workplace culture and microaggressions. Microaggressions in the workplace are everyday slights, insults, and negative verbal and nonverbal messages, sometimes intentional, sometimes not, that impede someone's ability to do their work well, show up, and thrive as their best self. That sounded familiar. I slowly began to realize that I wasn't failing. The culture around me was failing me. And data showed me I was not the only one. Similar behaviors in the workplace affect people of all underrepresented identities. This has a real impact on our colleagues, our companies, and our collective capacity to innovate. I began to see microaggressions everywhere, every day, particularly from a handful of my colleagues I interacted with daily. First, I observed them in wonder and shock, and then with anger and frustration. I tried to point them out, and that was a disaster. I tried asking people to close their laptops and put down their cell phones in meetings. Awful idea. They became angry and shut down completely. I tried sharing the data I analyzed in our company. We were losing women to turnover at alarming rates. Like several companies in the industry, we had a revolving door. On one side, we were working on recruiting diverse talent. On the other side, we were not retaining them. Women were leaving and going to our competitors. Astoundingly, company leaders told me they didn't care. All of this was devastating, and it took me some time to work out of a pit of despair and discouragement. What helped were long talks with my husband every night, finding ways to make a difference for people with underrepresented identities who worked for me, learning about how other companies improved their cultures, and reading stories of people who had experienced similar situations. One day, one of the principals in the company asked me to lunch and told me awkwardly, I've been wanting to say something for a while and wasn't sure how to say it. I think people are treating you differently because you're a woman. I was floored. I had no idea he was paying attention. He hadn't been in any meetings where I'd brought this up, and yet he noticed on his own. He told me he'd seen his wife struggle with the awful treatment she received from her colleagues in her career as an attorney, and he saw me experiencing similar things. Wow. Just that acknowledgement that someone who I don't know well was seeing what I was seeing. That was enough to make me feel not quite so alone. It helped. I found myself motivated to create societal change so that other people don't experience what I did, so that people of all backgrounds can be happier and truly thrive and lead in their workplace. My wheels were turning. In the meantime, I used my power of storytelling and behavior change to begin improving our company culture. I did this work while skirting the real issues. I did not talk about women, LGBTQIA+, Black, Latinx, and people with other underrepresented identities. No one wanted to hear it. Instead, I focused my work on emotional intelligence, employee engagement, and wellness. I call this covert culture change. Use it if you have to. The culture started to change a little bit, particularly on teams led by principals like the one who took me to lunch. Some of the leaders began to get it. Our engagement numbers improved significantly, especially for women, and our turnover decreased. When all you can do is create change covertly. Covert culture change is best when leadership and/or the culture overall is not ready to address diversity, equity, and inclusion directly. You can still move the needle in several ways to achieve the ultimate objectives of diversity, equity, and inclusion, without using those words at all. It can be taxing to work in a culture like this, but if you love your work and want to change the company culture, it's still possible. Wellness programs can improve engagement levels and overall health and well-being. Mindfulness and emotional intelligence programs can improve empathy skills. If done at the leadership level, these can create more empathetic leadership overall, and sometimes even open up leadership teams to be more receptive to conversations about inclusion in the future. Leadership development programs can help people with underrepresented identities grow their careers and move into leadership roles, and generally improve in
Sample complete. Ready to continue?